This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The United States approves another massive military weapons supply to Ukraine worth $675 million. Washington plans more arms delivery amid war with Russia. The death toll from massive floods in Pakistan rises to 1,355 as the country reels from devastating impacts of the natural disaster. And the spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says the IAEA's new report is a repetition of previous false allegations with political motivations. Thank you for joining us. The United States has pledged a massive military package for Ukraine amid the ongoing war with Russia.
And yesterday, the President approved the latest tranche of U.S. assistance to Ukraine, valued up to $675 million.
The package will include more ammunition, trucks, and anti-tank systems. The announcement was made during a meeting of defense ministers at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The U.S. has also unveiled nearly $2.7 billion in new military support to Ukraine and those neighbors Washington says are under threat from Russia. The foreign military financing program involves offering loans and grants to other countries to buy U.S.-made weapons. A State Department official says half of the new package will go to Ukraine and the rest to 18 other nations, including Moldova and Georgia, as well as several Baltic states. Italy has adopted energy-saving measures, including turning down thermostats as part of an EU plan to cut consumption. This as gas prices keep soaring amid the economic fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
The Italian government has introduced a number of measures aimed at curbing electricity consumption this winter amid soaring gas prices and fears of more disruptions. Italy relies on natural gas for 40% of its electricity production. On Tuesday, Roberto Cingolani, the Minister for the Ecological Transition, announced energy-saving measures ranging from turning down thermostats in apartment blocks and public buildings by 1 degree and shortening the time the heating can be on by 1 hour a day and 15 days across the year.
It could be a solution, but on second thought, I don't know how useful this measure would be. What I do know is that it's always us people who pay the price.
Hospitals, nursing homes, primary and play schools will be exempt from the energy-saving measures. The policy introduced by the Italian government is part of an EU plan which calls on member states to voluntarily reduce their gas demand by 15% compared to their average consumption in the past 5 years between August the 1st and March 31st next year. However, the gas demand reduction becomes mandatory if supplies reach crisis levels.
Italy has decided to do without the Russian gas, which amounted to about 40% of its supplies, and opted to embrace a supplier diversification strategy. Also, Germany did the same. Now it takes five members of the bloc to demand the European Council to make the energy saving plan mandatory. For instance, if Russia opts to cut altogether its gas supplies to Europe.
There are concerns on how the implementation of energy-saving measures will be monitored by the government. For now, the Ministry for the Ecological Transition has called on individuals to play their part. It remains to be seen whether this will be enough. Max Civilli, Rome.
The economic impact of the Russia-Ukraine war has also hit France. Ramin Mazari has more on this story from Paris.
France and Europe have begun power restrictions unseen since the energy crisis 50 years ago in the hope of avoiding rolling blackouts, rationing, shuttered factories, and recession this winter. However, that was before European gas prices exploded after Russia cut gas flows 4 months earlier than Europe expected. At the current prices, energy bills across Europe will be up over 200% compared with last winter, and would absorb 20% of the average household's budget. On a macro level, such an increase will require 2 trillion euros in additional spending across the continent, equivalent to 15% of Europe's gross domestic product, all caused by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine.
All of Europe's problems can be traced to the European Union's demands to end the state's monopoly over electricity, which had been perfectly handling the nation's energy needs in France and elsewhere. Private companies didn't make the necessary investments, and I am talking about even before the corona crisis froze everything. And today, no type of energy is prepared to handle our needs.
Most analysts agree that Brussels' latest response to try and cap Russian gas prices is hollow, unenforceable, and certain to end all gas shipments from Russia. The far right is leading vital elections this month in Italy, and its leaders are running on an end to Russia sanctions because they say Italy is already on our knees.
We're only at the beginning of this problem, that's for sure. This energy crisis is going to last for 2 or 3 years, and that's at a minimum. It's not an exaggeration to say that Europe truly has no solutions, and that our leaders are merely engaging in wishful thinking.
French President Emmanuel Macron recently made waves by saying the country needs to prepare for an era defined by the end of abundance. However, many note that assumes that Ukraine will be the only unexpected crisis which Europe has to deal with in the coming months and years.
The government has predicted that the average annual inflation for all of 2022 will be 5%. However, from supply chain disruptions in China to more sanctions on Russia to austerity demands from Brussels, there's room for things to get even worse.
Will the astronomical gas prices cause Brussels and Washington to end their standoff with Moscow? The European street may have the final say this autumn. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Reports coming out of the UK's Buckingham Palace say doctors are concerned about Queen Elizabeth's health. They have recommended the 96-year-old remain under medical supervision. The Buckingham Palace says the Queen remains comfortable at her house in Balmoral, Scotland. A palace source says the Queen's immediate family members have been informed of her health condition. Prince Charles is now with the Queen, and Prince William is travelling to her house after the announcement. Elizabeth II is the Queen of the United Kingdom and 14 other Commonwealth realms. Her reign began in February 1952. The death toll from flash floods in Pakistan continues to rise as people struggle to cope with the devastating impacts of the natural disaster. Authorities have reported 12 deaths in the past 24 hours. This brings the total number of fatalities to 1,355, which includes nearly 500 children. People in some parts of the country are building barriers against rising flood waters that have engulfed nearly a third of Pakistan after weeks of rain. The flooding has disrupted the lives of nearly 33 million people and is estimated to have caused losses of about $10 million. Hundreds of thousands have been forced from homes. The World Health Organization says more than 6 million people need humanitarian assistance in the flooded areas. The UN has called for $160 million in aid. Our Pakistan-based correspondent Nasser Kazmi has visited some of the flood-hit areas in the country. He gives us an update on the circumstances.
The infrastructure which is available at the moment with the government, they are trying their best to reach those people, but many of the people are still stranded in the flood waters in the southern part of Sindh, as well as in Balochistan. Many of the houses have been wiped away from those provinces, and people have no help at the moment. We have been visiting the flood-affected areas in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is one of the worst flood-affected province of Pakistan. Still, water, many of houses are underwater in those regions. Now, the water is affecting the Sindh province, and more rains are expected in days to come, as the Pakistan Meteorological Department has predicted that in the mid of September, there will be more rains in Pakistan. And meanwhile, the glaciers are also melting. So the heat wave in the country, same time, and the rains, they are affecting the people of Pakistan, and there are more fresh warnings about floods in those regions.
Iran has reacted to the latest report by the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear program. Tehran says the agency needs to act professionally and remain independent and impartial. Iran's permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna says the IAEA is expected to stick with its duties regardless of political pressure. Mohsen Naziri warned the UN body of mischievous behavior by third parties that possess dozens of nuclear warheads. Naziri said the safeguards issues between Iran and the IAEA were closed under the 2015 resolution by the agency's board of governors. The Iranian envoy said his country has always had constructive cooperation with the agency. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran also says the IAEA report contains no substantive material and that the agency is only playing politics with its repeated false allegations. It says Iran won't accept the monitoring of its nuclear activities beyond the safeguards agreement unless parties to the 2015 deal fulfill their obligations and remove the sanctions. In its new report, the IAEA has claimed Iran's stock uranium enriched to 60% purity is now enough for a nuclear bomb if enriched further. Political commentator Abbas Aslani says Israel is behind allegations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
There are some points which need to be taken into account. One is the source of those claims. Those are, I mean, brought up by a party who is not a member to the, let's say, NPT, or they have nuclear warheads, meaning Israel. And they have clear stances vis-a-vis Iran as well as its nuclear activities. So for sure they will try to fabricate, let's say, evidences in order to say and claim that Iran's nuclear activities are not peaceful. And the third point is that, you know, the timing of these, let's say, issues is very important, because at the time that these issues have been among those remaining, let's say, outstanding issues at the table, we have been seeing that the Western parties to the nuclear deal, as well as the IAEA Director General, they have been trying to exaggerate and focus on those issues in order to put pressure on Tehran at the negotiating table to get more concessions. And that's why Iran argues that the other parties want to keep, let's say, these issues for future in order to use them as political pretext for, let's say, future, let's say, pressure against Tehran.
Iran reacts to the latest accusations raised at the 158th meeting of the Arab League's foreign ministers, calling them biased and uninformed. The foreign ministry spokesman says those allegations show certain governments have no proper understanding of the course of developments in West Asia and the realities on the ground. The Arab League meeting was held in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, on Tuesday. In the final communique, the participants accused Iran of interfering in the internal affairs of Arab states. Nasser Kanani advised those states to focus on Israel's atrocities against Palestinians instead of using such empty and repetitive rhetoric. According to the official, Tehran, as always, is ready to engage in meaningful dialogue with its neighbors and to settle misunderstandings through diplomacy. South Korea is proposing to hold a new round of talks with the neighboring North over the issue of family reunions.
The Korean government offers talks with North Korea to discuss a reunion of separated families. This government is not considering special incentives when it comes to this kind of humanitarian matter. North Korea should respond to this offer for a reunion of separated families as it is a humanitarian matter.
Seoul is hoping that officials from both sides could soon meet in person to discuss the issue of families in the two Koreas, who were separated by war 7 decades ago. Seoul says it will be up to Pyongyang to decide the date, menu, agenda and the format of the talks. These families are allowed to get together for a few days occasionally. The last reunion happened 4 years ago. The North has not yet responded, but recently it turned down an offer of aid from the South in return for denuclearization. Seoul says it will keep making proposals even if Pyongyang rejects this offer. The Seoul Defense Dialogue discussed avenues of international cooperation as South Korea implements a hardline approach for Pyongyang. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another shooting rampage in the United States. Police in Memphis say a teenager has killed at least four people and wounded three others over the course of several hours. Police say they've arrested a 19-year-old suspect with two weapons following a high-speed chase. They say Kelly Live streamed parts of his spree at eight different scenes. Gun violence has become a daily occurrence in the U.S. So far this year, nearly 500 people have been killed in shootings and mass murders. But Congress is reluctant to pass gun control legislation as the issue remains politically divisive.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The escape of the Malaysian defense contractor at the center of the U.S. Navy's biggest corruption scandal is as stunning and brazen as the case itself. About a dozen U.S. law enforcement agencies are currently searching for Leonard Glenn Francis, known as Fat Leonard, but officials have acknowledged that he may well have fled to Mexico, and he could be on his way back to Asia. Please stay with us for more. This is how Britain's Guardian newspaper covered the story. The U.S. Marshals Service and other law enforcement agencies are facing questions over their competence after a central figure in the biggest scandal in U.S. naval history was able not only to escape house arrest, but also rented vans to load up his possessions. When marshals arrived at Leonard Francis's home in San Diego, California, on Sunday, 4th of September, they found he had cut off his GPS ankle bracelet and fled 2 weeks before his sentencing hearing. The whereabouts of the Malaysian contractor's three sons, who had been living with him, was unclear. Alerts were put out at ports, airports, and the nearby southern border with Mexico, but law enforcement officials conceded that Francis may already have escaped the country. The Regional Fugitive Task Force and the Naval Criminal Investigative Service were both reported to be helping with the manhunt. After being arrested in 2013 in a San Diego hotel room as part of a federal sting operation, Francis pleaded guilty over a vast corruption scheme in which U.S. naval officers were plied with food and drink, expensive gifts, and in return made sure U.S. naval vessels as big as aircraft carriers were diverted towards his Singapore-based company, Glenn Defense Marine Asia, for servicing. The affair in which the U.S. Navy was overcharged by an estimated $35 million is known as the Fat Leonard Scandal, a reference to Francis's body size. The San Diego office of the U.S. Marshals Service put up a wanted notice on Twitter on Tuesday. The San Diego Fugitive Task Force is searching for Leonard Francis, a.k.a. Fat Leonard. Francis, who was on home confinement and being monitored by the U.S. pretrial services, cut off his GPS bracelet and left his home, the notice said. Francis's lawyer, Devin Burstein, declined to comment. Francis had been a cooperating witness for federal prosecutors in their cases against senior U.S. naval officers. His own sentencing hearing had been repeatedly postponed, but was due to take place on 22nd of September. Francis's house arrest arrangements were highly unusual after he was released from prison in 2018 to undergo cancer treatment. He was being watched by a private security company paid for by Francis himself, which on a previous occasion was found to have left the house unsecured when a guard went for lunch. In the days before his disappearance, neighbors had seen U-Haul rental trucks coming and going to Francis's home, according to the Supervisory Deputy U.S. Marshal Omar Castillo. He was planning this out, that's for sure, Castillo told the San Diego Union-Tribune. In December of 2020, a judge in the Federal District Court in San Diego ordered a review of the security arrangement at Francis's house after a court officer made a routine check and found no security guard there for more than 2 hours. The security guard said later that he had gone for lunch. ABC News has also covered the story and gives us more details about the history of the case and what has happened. 3 weeks before he faced sentencing, the Malaysian defense contractor at the center of one of the biggest bribery investigations in U.S. military history made an escape as stunning and brazen as the case itself. U-Haul trucks were seen at his home in a Tony San Diego neighborhood before Leonard Glenn Francis, known as Fat Leonard, snipped off his ankle monitor and disappeared. Nearly a dozen U.S. law enforcement agencies were searching for Francis on Tuesday, 6th of September. But officials acknowledge he may already be in Mexico and possibly on his way back to Asia. 4 years ago, U.S. District Judge Janice Sammartino feared Francis might run off when she turned down his lawyer's request to allow him to be under house arrest without round-the-clock security guards watching the ailing defense contractor. At the time, Francis was cooperating with prosecutors as they pursued charges against dozens of U.S. Navy officials who accepted bribes in exchange for classified information that gave Francis ship servicing business in Asia an edge in getting military contracts. When asked about the bold escape on Tuesday, his lawyer, Devin Burstein, who pushed for more leniency for his client, said, "At this time, I have no comment to make." Judge Janice Sammartino repeatedly maintained that Francis, who was in poor health and needed medical care, could only remain under house arrest if private security guards were on site. At one point, she expressed concern that if he were to escape and end up back in Malaysia, for whatever reason, her name would come up if anyone asked, "Who let somebody do this without any security?" According to a transcript of a closed-door hearing in February of 2018 that was unsealed in January. She raised similar concerns in another hearing on 17th of December 2020 after receiving a report that the home was left without anyone guarding it for nearly 3 hours, according to the court transcript. The guard said he had been on a long lunch break and Francis apologized to the judge for the mishap. It was unclear if round-the-clock security guards were still in place this weekend. The U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego declined to comment, referring calls to the U.S. Marshals Service. Supervisory Deputy U.S. Marshal Omar Castillo said his officers found no security officers at the home when they arrived on Sunday afternoon, nearly 7 hours after Francis is believed to have removed his ankle monitor with heavy scissors. The device was found in the home. Castillo said someone called the San Diego Police Department, which sent officers to the home shortly before 2 p.m. on Sunday to check on it. Castillo said he did not know who made the phone call. After finding the home empty, police contacted U.S. pretrial services, the federal agency in charge of his confinement, which then called the U.S. Marshals Service. Castillo said he did not know if security guards were still ordered to be there. He said neighbors reported seeing U-Haul trucks coming and going from the home 1 or 2 days before the escape. Pretrial services declined to comment or answer any questions. The home is about 40 minutes' drive from the Mexico border, where vehicles stream into Tijuana and are only stopped randomly. Omar Castillo said Mexican authorities have been put on alert and 10 U.S. law enforcement agencies at local, state and federal levels was searching for Francis on Tuesday, 6th of September.
Hidden Files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. To many, mass executions and beheadings are ancient barbaric practices that don't belong in a civilized world. Of course, we have seen Western-backed Daesh terrorists do it for the camera. But surely, it's only such heartless terrorists that commit such heinous crimes. No internationally recognized entity could possibly be guilty of mass executions. Or could it? Well, today we will travel to a corner of the world in which, in only one such instance, 81 people were executed. And yet, somehow, mainstream media has barely touched on this appalling crime and has basically hidden it from the public eye. But that's precisely the kind of file that we at Hidden Files are here to expose. So watch the next clip and follow the rest of the show, because whether or not mainstream media agrees, you have the right to know.
The 2002 mass execution was the third of its kind in 6 years. In April 2019, 37 men, mostly Shia, were beheaded in the kingdom. Also in January 2016, 47 people were executed, including prominent Shia scholar Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. But Saudi crimes also reach far and well beyond the country's borders. In 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. citizen and columnist for the Washington Post, was cut into pieces using a saw inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, which surprisingly did not have an adverse effect on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. More shocking still was how, even though the U.S. announced Saudi Arabia responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks, saying that nearly all of those involved were trained in Saudi Arabia, the U.S.-Saudi relationship remained intact. Syed Hamza al-Shakouri from Awamiya is a founder and member of the Khalas movement, formed in 2004. The Khalas movement is a dissident group with members inside Saudi Arabia, as well as in many countries around the world. The members are both young and old and from different Islamic schools of thought, but they all share a single goal: to raise awareness about and stop the oppression of people inside Saudi Arabia. Mr. al-Shakouri had to flee Saudi Arabia and is now a vocal dissident in New Zealand.
thank you so much. I'd like to welcome Mr. Al-Shakouri to the program. A pleasure having you with us. Can you tell us about the latest mass execution that took place in Saudi Arabia?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I am here with you because I am a dissident of the Saudi regime and representative of my community, which are oppressed in the Arabian Peninsula and Hejaz. In this country, nobody is able to express his ideas freely on what is happening to him. So we're forced to leave the country and live in exile and be away from the pressure of the Saudi persecution, so we can show the injustice of our community and to express its suffering and expose the oppression which they are being subjected to. Whether it's in Al-Qatif and Al-Ahsa, or in Mecca and Medina or Hijaz, or even in the Najd and Asir, even if we fled our ancestral homes in Al-Qatif, we carry the concern of the entire population of the Arabian Peninsula and Hijaz.
When the Saudi regime says that the 81 people that were executed that day were all terrorists, I mean, what do you say to that? What do you have to say?
The big massacre in the month of Sha'ban, the Saudi regime executed 81 people, among them 41 Shia, and among those were children. The trial did not even conclude for the majority of these people. What occurred was a swift operation in the final moments in order to present this number and behead them with a sword in an ugly, bloody, barbaric massacre of Shias and Sunnis from different regions in Saudi Arabia. Among them was my younger brother, Muhammad Al-Shakouri, my cousin, Syed Asad Maki Al-Syed Shabar Al-Syed Ali, and among them was a large amount from Al-Awamiya, from which they executed 28 martyrs who were beheaded on that day. These people, many of their family until today, do not know precisely. We say they were beheaded, but we do not know in a certain and definitive manner what happened. It is possible they were killed via other methods. It is possible bullets were fired at them or they were buried alive. The Saudi government does not disclose or announce anything, the timing, place, or how the execution was carried out. All of this information we do not know. Our families received reports of the execution from the TV, newspapers, social media, Twitter, Facebook, and such like. Even the families who visited their sons a week before the execution. The martyr that was executed did not know this would be his final meeting, nor did the family of the martyr know that this would be the last moment they would see their son.
Well, I mean, how likely is it possible that some of them are guilty of terrorism charges?
Firstly, I will start with a quick point. The Saudi regime terror does not need any evidence. The Saudis export terrorism across the globe. Who established Daesh with the cooperation of American intelligence? Who sent explosives and suicide bombers to Iraq? Who sent and backed suicide bombers to fight alongside Daesh and the Nusra Front in Syria? Is there anyone else that funded them apart from the Saudis with American and Western intelligence? Who kidnapped, killed, and dismembered Khashoggi inside the consulate? How did they cut him to pieces? They declared that Khashoggi departed the consulate. And only after the Turks exposed the atrocity with photos and videos was the Saudi regime forced to acknowledge, but they still tried to avoid complicity by saying those were rogue agents. The bloody, barbaric exportation of Saudi crimes has reached India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and even Iran. They didn't leave one region alone. Who committed the 9/11 attacks? Was it not the Saudis? Saudi terrorism is so clear that it doesn't need discussion or providing evidence about it. It's occurring in front of our eyes. It's occurring in front of the eyes of the world and is happening outside the perimeters and territories of the Arabian Peninsula and Hejaz. So what does this say about what is happening inside the Saudi mortal, and I don't say Saudi kingdom? So we, our people and family who are inside, we are under the authority of an oppressive terrorist regime. Of course it's going to accuse us of going above the law and similar accusations. Those who were executed, the majority of them were protesters, civilians who came out for peaceful protests, demanding their rights, equality, democracy, freedom, free elections, fairness, and justice in the distribution of the national resources. They are demanding services and their right to employment, housing, education, and medical care. This is why they took to the streets. These are not terrorists. Yes, maybe we don't know all 81 were executed, but we are sure of the 41 who are our family from Al-Ghatif. Those I know personally and closely. But let's say, for example, that among the 81, there were a limited number of 3, 4, maybe less, maybe more, that are affiliated with Daesh, for example, or to Al-Qaeda. Was it the sin of the rest? And those affiliated with Daesh or Al-Qaeda, do they not have the right to a fair trial? Do they not have the right to a transparent and open trial? Do they not have the right to appoint an attorney and appear on the TV screens, for example, and the trials are conducted in a transparent and public way? And then, whoever is proven against him that he engaged in terror or killing or such, that person is prosecuted within a legal framework. But you gather 81 people and label them all as terrorists, as killers or practiced violence. This is a kangaroo court. We cannot accept that.
Well, you're talking about major human rights violations. Did any human rights organization get involved? Have they been aggressive in following this up?
To answer this question, allow me to clarify a little and make it clear, because the matters are intertwined and there are several dimensions. The first issue is that there are activists, advocates, both in Europe and America. They sympathize with us. They have a sense of humanity and a clear conscience. Most of them are sincere, speaking generally. We trust their sympathy, solidarity, and humanity. However, as people and individuals, their position does not influence national policy. When it comes to Western governments, the Western political system, even international human rights organizations, they are affiliated to a Western agenda. They're affiliated to the agenda of American and Western intelligence. The West stops with just condemnation. They only sell us talk without any action. These condemnations are fruitless. Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi authorities will not be able to carry out such crimes and continue committing terror if it was not for the backing and support of the West and its governments. Mohammed bin Salman is simply an official of the West. He is being used as a puppet. The West, in particular America, if they wanted to even replace King Salman and his son from the throne of the kingdom, they can do that. So the Arab governments, and especially the Persian Gulf sheikhdoms, generally are puppets in implementing the agenda of the West. The West stops with just talk, condemnations, and declarations. This does not change anything. What we are demanding is a true stance and active stances. Over the past 5 years, the Saudi regime has committed 3 barbaric massacres. In the first massacre, it executed Ayatollah Sheikh al-Nimr, along with 46 other people. and then it executed 37 people, among them Sheikh Mohammed Al-Atiyah and others. Now we have another massacre with 81 victims. And the Khashoggi crime case is still not settled. What has the West done in the face of these crimes? What is the West doing today against the Saudi regime over its crimes in Yemen, for example? The starvation of millions of Yemenis as a result of the blockade it imposes on the Yemeni nation. What has the West done as Saudis kill thousands in Yemen? Who arms Saudi Arabia and signs weapons contracts with them? Is it not America and the Western countries? The reality is, Western governments view our regions only as storage facilities for their energy, the oil and the gas. This is what the West is gambling on. They do not care about values, equality, human rights, or the life of our people, nor the sanctity of their blood. How can a country execute 81 men on the same day and not be condemned by countries which say that protecting human lives and human rights are some of their main responsibilities in the world? Let's look at some of the reactions from some countries and entities when it became known that the Saudi regime had murdered 81 people in one day. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet voiced her concern over the extremely broad definition of terrorism in Saudi legislation, which led to holding unfair trials and executions of dozens of dissidents in the Saudi kingdom. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price, in a briefing, did not condemn Saudi allies for the mass executions. He only spoke of fair trial guarantees in the Saudi kingdom. The EU stated it remains concerned about the continued use of capital punishment in Saudi Arabia and will continue to raise its position with the Saudis. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson visited Saudi Arabia within a week of the executions, not to condemn Riyadh for the killings, but to try to get Saudi Arabia to pump more oil. These reactions should come as no surprise. If we rewind back to October of 2018, we will recall the heinous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. He was killed and sawed into pieces inside of the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was a journalist and Washington Post columnist, a Saudi dissident and an American permanent resident. There was a lot of noise made about his murder, just because of the shocking way it took place and that Khashoggi's fiancée was waiting outside for him to come out of the consulate. But Saudi Arabia never faced any ramifications for murdering this American resident. In February of 2021, U.S. intelligence agencies reported that the Saudi de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, approved the assassination of Khashoggi. Despite all of this, recently, bin Salman got the red carpet treatment in France and from its president, Emmanuel Macron. And U.S. President Joe Biden actually flew to Saudi Arabia to meet with MBS. So what expectations can the world really have of these countries caring about and holding the regime responsible for the execution of 81 Saudi and Yemeni nationals? The reality is that oil rules. Petrol is prioritized over people and profit over justice for these governments. The only justice for the regime's crimes will come at the hands of its own people and not anyone else.
Do you think your country will change?
Saudi crimes are old and committed as they began occupying these regions. And all this occurred at the time under the guise of the British. The English were present to create this artificial entity. As for will it change? Yes, it will change. We are faithful that we are capable of implementing this change. However, this needs time, work, and activity. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, says, "Strive to pass honor to your children." Today, we must work to plant the seeds. We must tire ourselves. We must sacrifice whatever we can, no matter how much we suffer and sacrifice, so that our children are able to live freely, to enjoy their pride and honor.
But if we sit back and watch on without debating, speaking out, taking any action, without struggling, then Al Saud will remain in power. Yes, this rule will pass away. The monarchy of Al Saud will pass away, and we have real experience today. How is Ansarullah, the Yemeni people, the army, and popular committees facing a global war and blockade imposed on them, despite such little capabilities? They did not flee from their coalition, which includes firstly the Americans, the Zionists, the West, and then the Emiratis and the Saudis. This defenseless people managed to gain experience, power, and counterattack the enemy's war that is being launched by the Saudi coalition. We also have capabilities too in our region, and there are 2 million Shia Muslims only in Al-Ghatib and Al-Aqsa who are being hurt by this regime. Our brothers in Hijaz, our brothers in Asir, today there is an opposition from different religious sects and different regions. And we are in cooperation and coordination, and we are confident in God.
Now, you may wonder how, despite all of this, the regime remains a close U.S. ally and enjoys impunity from sanctions and other preventative measures. And just a few years ago, was even appointed the head to a key United Nations human rights panel. Well, the answer lies in what inspired former U.S. President Donald Trump to call the Saudi regime the milk cow of the U.S. Let's take a look at this.
U.S. administrations have long allied themselves with Saudi Arabia, and the Trump administration is no exception. But in view of continued human rights abuses by the Saudis, including the murder and dismemberment of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, I asked the president why he's overruled Congress to allow more arms sales to Saudi Arabia. His answer, boiled down in a word, money.
They buy massive amounts, $150 billion worth of military equipment that, by the way, we use their military equipment. And unlike other countries that don't have money and we have to subsidize everything, so Saudi Arabia is a big buyer of America product. That means something to me. It's a big producer of jobs.
Of course, the Saudi regime has made clear efforts to change its public image into a more progressive one, such as loosening the country's tight restrictions on drinking, gambling, and concerts. But to those who are fighting for their rights inside, the kingdom will remain a land of silencing people's voices and eliminating opposition through mass executions. Yet the human cost will remain overlooked by mainstream media so long as major powers can continue to milk this cow. So it's up to us to stay alert and active and to enhance the voices of those less heard. For many of you out there, today's story was a personal account, but the story of many more remains untold, and that's what we're here for. So contact us and share your story and stay with us for the journey, as next week we will be zooming in on somewhere else that corporate media is trying to ignore. Thanks so much for being with us right here at Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Until next time, stay inquisitive.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.